And welcome once again to the program. Now, you need to be relaxed for today's edition of Future Tense, and we're starting in Italy. So I've asked the Sound Library people for some appropriate Italianish music to put us in the mood. All right, let's try this one first. Here we go. Remember, think Italian and think relaxed. Oops, no, not that one. All right, well, they've given me another one here, so let's see whether this one flies. Ah, much better. Now, I want us in the right frame of mind because we're talking today about the slow movement. Yes, we all know about slow food, or most of us probably do, but that's just a part of it. But having mentioned food, let's begin there, because understanding the background to the slow food push helps us understand the ethos behind the wider movement. Jeff Hudson is the chairman of the not-for-profit organisation Slow Food Australia.
Well, the slow food movement was established in Italy in 1986 and became an international association in 1989. Carlo Petrini was the man behind it all, and it really was in response to concern about the entry of fast food into Italy, I guess, and this was sort of a tongue-in-cheek, in some respects, naming to identify all those things that weren't sort of fast food, that were where food was prepared with care and skill and enjoyed by people. The philosophy, the mantra, if you like, is good, clean, and fair, and that relates to food and the production of the food. So the good really relates to taste, that food should have good taste and good flavour and be a pleasurable experience to eat. Clean relates to the preparation of or growing of food, use of chemicals, etc., or the lack of use of chemicals. Intensive agriculture is not something that is encouraged. Battery-raised chickens would be bad news. It really is in an endeavour to get back to some natural values in food. And fair relates to providing those growers with a reasonable return for their efforts.
Incidentally, the slow food movement has members in over 132 countries. But Jeff Hudson's chapter, it seems, is the only national association in the Southern Hemisphere. We'll come back to food a little later. But let's now get a bit of an overview of the broader movement and its parts from Canadian author and blogger Carl Honoré.
The slow movement now really has reached out and touched every sphere of human activity. I mean, a lot of people will know slow food, but that's just the tip of an enormous iceberg. There are movements for slow cities. Now it's about redesigning the urban landscape in ways that encourage people to put on the brakes. You see the slow idea moving into the world of design, slow design. There's a slow technology movement. There's slow sex, slow parenting, slow education. There's even the fashion world, which, of course, defines itself by speed. There's a growing move towards what they call slow fashion. There's slow research, slow science. Slow travel has become a huge force in the tourism and travel industry as people try and find different ways to take holidays and to move around the planet. So I think that this idea of slow is, once you get it in your head, you realize that it can revolutionize everything you do. And I find that every time I almost open up my inbox or take a look around, there seems to be another slow movement or other appearing. You know, there's been a lot of hoo-ha in the United States about a slow reading movement, you know, rethinking how we approach prose on the page and reading more deeply and with more concentration. A slow libraries movement, which is connected to that, a slow books movement. There's a slow art movement, getting away from the kind of, you know, disposable conceptual modern art that fills up a lot of museums and getting to something a bit more solid and thoughtful. You know, so there are lots of different ways this can go, and in some ways I think that's what's really thrilling, is that there are no limits to this. You can take this slow idea, no one owns it, you don't have to sign up or, you know, pay for a patent. You just take the idea and you put it into practice and you run with it.
Now, when Carl Honoré came out with his book, In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed, it quickly became a bestseller. The world, he said, was living in fast forward, and most of us were in danger of becoming addicts.
I think it's reached the stage now where we have become speed junkies, where we find it very hard to step away from the treadmill of acceleration, and we're constantly marinated in distraction and stimulation and activity and so on. And just think in your own life or the lives of listeners, you know, when we find ourselves taken off the grid, when we are forced to unplug, maybe the phone is down or the computer's come, we don't rejoice when we suddenly find ourselves with a moment of silence or quiet. We fidget and panic and start shifting around, looking for something else to plug that space, that void. And I think that we've kind of lost the ability just to stop and to reflect and to be quiet and still. And I think it has reached a stage now where we are kind of collectively addicted to the drug that is speed.
So if we have this addiction to speed in our lives, what are some of the, some of the stranger ways in which it manifests itself, do you think?
Well, I think our addiction to speed is carrying us into absolutely absurd lengths nowadays. There, near my house in London, there's a gym that offers an evening course now in speed yoga. This is for, you know, it's for time-starved professionals who want to salute the sun and bend their bodies into the lotus position, but they want to do it in 20 minutes instead of a whole hour. And I thought that speed yoga was the most ludicrous manifestation of this roadrunner culture until a friend of mine in the United States got invited to a drive-through funeral. Church places a coffin at the entrance, people pull up in their cars, wheel down the window, throw a flower, say goodbye, and off they go. It's like getting a Big Mac at a drive-through McDonald's. And a couple of months ago, I gave a talk at a church in Vienna, Austria, and afterwards the Monsignor, the head of the church, came up to me slightly sheepishly and said, you know, it's funny, when you were talking, I suddenly realized how easy it is for all of us to get caught up in this speed approach. And he said to me, you know, when you were talking, I suddenly realized that I've been praying too fast. You know, if we've got to the stage where even, you know, Monsignors high up in the church are praying and fast forward, then we've really lost our bearings.
I think the term slow media really means different things to different people, since media has sort of seeped into our lives and our culture in so many different ways. The few main things that I would emphasize are the idea of quality over quantity, the idea that faster does not necessarily mean better, and also the idea of paying attention and being more contemplative about what we use and how we use it.
Meet Jennifer Rorsch. She's been a reporter for various media organisations, and she's currently an associate professor of journalism at Long Island University in the US. For a while now, she's been writing a popular blog called Slow Media, which is subtitled A Compendium of Artifacts and Discourses Regarding Digital Disenchantment and the Possibilities for a Less Mediated Life. Ordinarily, I'd encourage you to go and have a look, and I guess I still do, but with the caveat that there isn't much new there, because on the 30th of June, Ms. Rorsch went offline as part of an experiment. She believes communications technology has an inflated role in our culture.
At the end of the day, time is finite, and time that we choose to spend doing certain things is time that we spend not doing other things. I found that over the past few years, the time that I spent looking at screens, whether it's interacting with internet or with cell phones, has increased bit by bit to the point now where other things have been crowded out. That's where I got the idea for slow media, that in order to bring things into my life that had been pushed aside, I would have to give up something else. And in this case, the biggest time suck, as they say for me, was the time that I spend on the internet.
And just to be clear, you're not anti the internet or anti digital media at all, are you?
No, I love the internet and I love digital media. It's not necessarily an easy decision for me to push it out of my life. There have just been too many days where I wake up and I have my coffee and my breakfast and I go on the internet to check my email, and before I know it, 6 or 8 hours have slid past that I've been reading emails, sending emails, clicking onto links, checking my Facebook, just sort of trolling my way around the web. And at the end of the day, I feel like I haven't achieved anything that I had really set out to do with my limited time on Earth.
And now, you took the decision to go offline for a period of time. Why was that? Why did you need to go offline and not just scale back the amount of time you were spending online?
I have tried to scale back in some ways. One of the techniques that I started doing was to go offline on one day a week, usually on Sundays, where I would just retrain myself to not carry my cell phone around, to not go on the internet and respond to emails. From there, it sort of escalated. Part of it has to do with my role as a teacher and as a scholar, that this is something that I've addressed in the classes that I teach as well as in some of the research that I do. But my interest in it sort of at the more cerebral level also was interacting with my experiences as a human being. So I guess I can say that in a way I was motivated to explore slow media as a teacher and a scholar as well as a human being. But I think that probably being a contrarian has more to do with it than anything else, that the more I talked to people about the idea of going offline and the more they told me that it was impossible, the more it sort of stoked me to prove that I could do it.
And now, in addition to your experiment, you've also set an assignment for your students about slow media. What was the focus of that assignment?
The idea behind that assignment was to turn my students into fish out of water in a way that, to paraphrase the media theorist Marshall McLuhan, he liked to say that we don't know who discovered water, but it probably wasn't a fish because you take it for granted as such an important element in your environment. So in order to get my students thinking more critically about the role of media in their lives, the best technique for that seems to be to get the media out of their lives and to have them spend a day where they couldn't go online and they couldn't use their cell phones. Needless to say, most of my students found this extremely difficult to do. Some of them managed to make it through the day with a lot of difficulty, and they found that they missed these little devices and were always wondering what they were missing out on and missed the connection with their friends, their family, or whoever else, you know, they were used to having just a few clicks away. Some of my students didn't even take the assignment very seriously because they just thought it was impossible to achieve, and they doubted the desirability of even trying to get away from digital media for a day. And they more or less admitted in their assignments that they had done it for the morning or maybe for half of the day, but then at the end of the day, the middle of the day, suspense got the better of them, and they just decided that they couldn't do it. The important thing about my work with my students is that I did two variations on the experiment. The first experiment was phrasing things as a negative, telling students that they couldn't use their internet or their cell phone for a whole day. And most of them seemed to think that that was creating this void that was impossible to fill, in which time went so slowly and they were bored and the assignment was just too hard for them to complete. The second version that I got after gauging their reactions to the first one was not to tell them that they could spend a day without using the internet and cell phones, but rather the assignment became that they should spend a day using all of these slow forms of media that they probably just don't use in their daily lives anymore. Some of them chose to watch old VHS tapes that they hadn't watched since they were young, to listen to records that their parents had, to play musical instruments or to make art or to write in their journals. And once it turned into a focus on slow media and the positive benefits of that rather than the negative aspects of criticizing the digital technologies that they were so attached to, they found that the assignment was a lot easier and a lot more fun, and they wrote these glowing journal reports about how much they had enjoyed their days using these things that, unless I had made them, they probably would never have done of their own accord.
And on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC Online, this is Future Tense with Anthony Fennell.
Slow cities now, and to Paul Payton from regional New South Wales.
As a result of slow food movement developing in Italy in about 86, a group of people were sitting around having a lovely lunch in a slow food manner, and all of a sudden the idea came up with, hang on, there's more than food we have to be worried about. The world out there is changing, globalization, technology, fuel, power, waste, pollution, you know, crime, all these sorts of things became into a different focus. And the idea was, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we overlaid the slow food concepts and ethics onto a slow city, onto the city, onto a community, onto a village. And that's really there how it came to be Chitta Slow, Slow City.
Now, we're about halfway through the program, and this seems a good place to pause. Because I think by this stage, we've got a good idea of the philosophical basis of the slow movement and the nature of the people involved. What we'll do now is look at some of the difficulties of trying to match implementation with ideal. And we've had a glimpse of this already from Jennifer Rorsch, with some of her young students finding the whole idea of slow just too difficult to comprehend. Anyway, back to Paul Payton. He lives in the Blue Mountains, centred around Katoomba. And Katoomba is one of 130 towns worldwide belonging to the Chitta Slow or Slow City movement. There are currently only two slow cities in this country. The other is Goolwa in South Australia. Now, both received accreditation from the peak body in Italy in 2007. And a requirement of membership was the support of their local government authority. So, how's it been going? Well, in the Blue Mountains, which includes 26 separate villages, it's been a challenge. And in a world of spin, it's refreshing to hear Paul Payton admit that. So how many people in the Blue Mountains have embraced the slow city concept?
A rather small number, to be honest, Anthony. It's been now 3 years. We're going into the idea of having to go through our reaccreditation, so we're reviewing this whole thing now. The idea was to set up, or the idea is to set up projects and develop connections with community bodies and organisations and people, engage them in the whole concept of understanding and living Chitter Slow life. We've put up some big projects. One of them was called a kitchen garden in every Blue Mountains home, and we aligned with a large nursery organisation here. They organised discounted and stock for seedlings and seeds, and we ran workshops to encourage and engage and educate people on how to have kitchen gardens in a box, or kitchen gardens in a water tank, or kitchen gardens in a ground, whatever, whole variety. And we've been running that now for a couple of years. We also put half wine barrels down the street, the main street of Katoomba, with herbs and vegetables, some, and trees and bay leaves and things like that, to bring flowers and vegetables and plant life into the main street, which is pretty much devoid. We also have a project which goes into cooking classes and how to pot and preserve and cooking with weeds, for example, heritage vegetables. So we explore those sorts of things. To give a number across the whole Blue Mountains, I suspect it's probably not more than really a couple of thousand people who are actively aware of and maybe even part of. So this is part of our challenge. We are volunteer-driven, supported only. We have the need to call on people for funding or whatever, or it doesn't happen, and that's where I'm also looking at marketing plan development and so forth.
Is size an issue here? I mean, is this a concept that's going to work in a village setting, in an homogenous village setting, but not necessarily going to operate in a region where you've got multiple town centres or multiple villages?
That's a good point. In fact, it's probably part of our greatest challenge is that we have the upper, lower and middle mountains, and there's a certain consciousness around that whole separation. And, you know, Bullabara, don't go down to Bullabara because it's, in the middle, and you can go to Wentworth Falls, that's like next up, but you don't have to, things like this. Indeed, to quote Gulwa, it's perhaps a greater example of how it can work. That really is a smaller town. I think there's only about 35,000 or something. It's already a tourist destination for their wooden boat festival they have once a year or biannually. It's probably more effective and more demonstrated and more involving of people there. So, yes, we have a challenge, of course, of the spread. However, Chitter Slow could even be a large suburb in a city. In other words, if there was the cohesion or spirit of community within a suburb which had about 30, 40, 50,000 people, then it could work in that way too. Though we are strung out across how many miles? I don't know, 80 kilometres or something. So we've even got a distance tyranny happening here. So it could work better than it is here, yes.
Now, you say now a challenge. Yeah. You've got accreditation coming up again. Are you confident, though, that you will be reaccredited?
We have actually progressed. There are 92 questions which we have to rate ourselves 1 to 3, 1 being a beginning, 2 being sort of operating, 3 being pretty much full on and continuing. We've got to now run that, and I'm going to say that we will be a little bit touch and go in some areas. We've had a change of mayor, and we're actually having re-engagement, not challenges, but exercise there. We have also a diminishment of team members due to illness and so forth. So, yeah, it's going to be a bit of a challenge, but there's still, I think, sufficient energy to run it through.
Okay, now where were we at? We know that the concept of going slow is attractive to more and more people, that it's as much a rejection of commercialisation and industrialisation as it is about going back to a simpler, healthier lifestyle. It's a vision of the future that can be enticing, but is it a vision of the future that's attainable by the majority? Let's go back to Jeff Hudson from Slow Food Australia to probe that issue of economies of scale. Whether it's slow food or slow cities or slow anything else, can slow be done on a mass scale, and can it be affordable for the masses?
There are financial imperatives. It is, the reason that food is produced in the way that it is, supermarket food, for want of a better term, is that it is cheaper. And people, whose principal focus is on cost, thereby take advantage of that opportunity to buy cheaper food. I think the educational process really can probably only offer people who think about their food and take care about their food and presumably are prepared to perhaps pay a little bit more money and eat a little bit less. It will, as you say, never replace the commercial production of food, but, you know, there are directions within that. You know, you look at what people are doing now, you know, with home vegetable gardening. They're reducing the amount of material, you know, vegetables they need to buy from supermarkets because they're growing a lot of their own stuff. They'll never grow everything that they need, but, you know, there is that partial replacement.
What would you say to the criticism that some people have made that the slow food movement appeals more to the wealthy inner city types?
Certainly to date, it's a bit of a focus on perhaps inner city and people who enjoy gathering to have meals, to learn about food preparation. I think what slow food in Australia is endeavouring to do is to introduce more broader educational and political involvement so that we do have a say if there is an issue that becomes newsworthy, that slow food has a say and presents its opinion.
But I guess I guess the criticism is that this is really something that's focused around a trendy elite, if you like. You don't accept that?
I think that you can make that criticism. No, I don't accept it at all. I think there are a lot of people in the slow food movement who you could, I guess, describe as in that way. But there are also a very large number who are people who have a genuine interest and concern about where the direction that we're heading with food in this country. And it's quite frightening, really, when you get into the detail of commercial food and feedlotting and all of that sort of thing and hormone-encouraged growth promotants in beef cattle. You know, I think there are a lot of people within the movement who are committed to, you know, the good, clean and fair mantra and, you know, are very involved with organic gardening, for example, or concern about food production in general.
When the slow food movement started and first came to my attention, I was very impressed because I like the idea of opposing or resisting the notion of fast food, food that people had from fast food restaurants and that depended on industrial food system to produce large quantities of commodities such as hamburger or potatoes or whatever. However, as the movement evolved, it became associated with a kind of part of the food movement, the community food movement or the foodie movement, if you will, that is associated with fairly high-end kinds of farm production and shopping experiences and dining experiences. It's all good in the sense of there's real food, but it's not so good in that the prices are high and those outlets, those channels of getting food to people don't have impact on the neighborhoods which have the least access to healthy food. Low-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods of color, and that became a concern to me.
For California-based Hank Herrera, it's all about access and inclusion. 2 years ago, he bravely stood up in front of a major conference organised by Slow Food USA and called on those present to remember the less well-off. Hank Herrera.
A number of us in what we call the food justice movement have tried to carefully and respectfully and constructively present a critique to the slow food movement that says, you know, we need to address issues of inclusiveness. Poor people want healthy, good food as much as anyone else. And the major issues of food access in the United States, at least, and I think perhaps in other countries of the world, but, you know, I live here, those problems of food access disproportionately affect low-income communities of color. And so we're trying to address those issues, and we've had some success. The Changemakers Day at Slow Food Nation, where a group of us spoke together, and Josh Viertel, who's now the president of Slow Food USA, was on that panel. We addressed these issues, and Josh had a really positive response and has kind of made it part of his vision and mission for Slow Food to address these disparities in access. So that part's good, but a lot of people who are associated with the slow food movement, you know, it's not like anybody's to blame. It's just like people do what they know how to do. And so when people come from backgrounds that have more resources, that's what they know. And they and people don't know other communities. But there tends to be this continuation of a disproportionate involvement of people who have more resources, more privilege, if you will. And what we're trying to do is get that slowly but surely to change. And so it's a long educational process.
I think there are aspects of slow expressions of the slow movement that are only ever going to be within the reach and the grasp of the upper middle class and the affluent. I mean, if you're thinking of hand-gathered truffles from the Italian forests outside Milan, I mean, not everybody's ever going to be able to afford that kind of slow delicacy. But the other end of that slow food spectrum is anyone on any income can go into a supermarket and buy some dried pasta, a few tomatoes, a piece of garlic, go home and make a pasta for, you know, a family of four, sit around the table with the television switched off and have a conversation. And that costs a lot less than going even to McDonald's, you know, to feed the same family. So I think even just that one example of food, it's there that the slow, whether it's food or slow design or slow sex, I mean, whatever you take, you bring the slow ethos to bear on, it's there for everyone, because ultimately, I think slow is a state of mind. It's about how you use time, and it's about how you approach every moment of the day. Do you arrive at every task thinking, how can I do this as quickly as possible? Or do you arrive thinking, how do I do this as well as possible, and how do I get the most out of it?
Author Carl Honoré, and before him, Hank Herrera from Dig Deep Farms and Produce. And Hank is also a former project manager of the Hope Collective in Oakland, California. Now, I want to finish off with Carl Honoré, and specifically on the relationship between commercialism and slow. For a natural-born skeptic like me, it's hard not to notice that the big corporations have also discovered the idea of slow, and that they're increasingly co-opting the words and veneer of the slow movement to push their mass-produced products, be they food or travel or whatever. I know it's an issue for someone like Hank Herrera, but is it a serious concern? Carl Honoré again.
I can understand where that concern comes from, but in some ways I would flip it around and say, isn't that a good sign? Because any time a social or cultural movement, it catches the attention of advertisers or people who are seeking to make money, it shows that that movement has real weight and ballast, and that it has moved to a central place in the cultural discussion. And the same thing happened to, you know, the Green Movement, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, all of these great movements that have shaken the foundations of our culture and made us rethink how we fit into the world and where we all want to go together in the future. They've all had, on the margin, at the very least, people stepping up and trying to sell, whether it's, you know, feminine protection or cigarettes or alcohol, you know, using all of these, the popularity, the strength and the attraction of this idea to sell things. I'm not particularly worried about that. It's inevitable. It will happen. I think that the test is, the challenge is to make sure that the idea itself remains pure and that enough people understand what it is and pursue it for its own sake rather than to make money. And I think the slow philosophy is so simple. It's as simple as saying doing everything at the right speed. Very, very simple idea that can spread right through the cultural conversation like a meme. And some people will try and hook onto that and hijack it for financial gain. But many, many other people will say, you know what, that makes me think differently about how I raise my family. Or, you know what, I think I can run my company in a different way because of that simple idea. And I think that is where the real impact of slow lies. And the other stuff is sort of incidental, I think, in a way.
Carl Honoré. And incidentally, we're informed that the Victorian town of Yay may soon be joining the ranks of the Chittislow movement. We'll keep you posted on that one.